This episode of the Jonah Carey Podcast is brought to you by FanDuel. FanDuel, listen, fantasy sports, we like it. Football, we continue to be ambivalent about it. But if you want to play fantasy sports easily and with a lot of fun involved, it's very easy to do. FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button and enter promo code Jonah. That's J-O-N-A-H. It's fantasy football for everyday fans. New contests starting every week. No busted seasons. Something for everyone. Lots of contests to choose from, starting at $1. $1. You pick a contest, choose your team, watch your score real time. It is that easy. More than 2.5 million players have won a cash prize playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. So sign up today. Go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and use the promo code Jonah. And there you go. That's all you got to do. New users get free entry to the NFL Sunday Million with more than $1 million in cash prizes when you make your first deposit on FanDuel. It's FanDuel.com. Sign up with the promo code Jonah. FanDuel.com. Promo code Jonah. Thank you to FanDuel for sponsoring the podcast. And welcome to the Jonah Carey Podcast. This episode is with Rich Griffin. Rich Griffin is a legend. I'm going to just put it out there like that. A wonderful human being. Who I've gotten a chance to know a little bit in the last couple of years when I was working on my book Up, Up, and Away about the Montreal Expos. Rich was the PR guy for the Expos for many years, and PR guys have the best stories. And Rich has some beauties in this one. It doesn't really matter if you're an Expos fan or not. You'll get a kick out of this kind of old-timey baseball talk. Some really, really fun stuff, behind-the-scenes stuff. Rich is now a columnist for the Toronto Star, does a great job there. A great dude. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. And I hope that you do too. Some quick programming notes. We've got CBS Sports, lots of stuff as always. I'm writing about the Diamondbacks this week. I'm not exactly sure when this is going to come out soon. So you'll be reading this maybe by the time you listen to this. If not, then soon afterwards. Diamondbacks are really good all of a sudden. They were not good last year. And the story of the turnaround of their pitching staff in particular is quite impressive. And talk to a bunch of the head people in that organization to get a feel for how they did it, how they've been able to do it. The Diamondbacks are a big-time sleeper. I like them a lot in this year's playoffs. I understand they're going to be in a wild card game, which means they could be one and done. But if they can get past probably the Rockies, but maybe the Brewers or the Cardinals, watch out for the Diamondbacks. They're really good. That J.D. Martinez trade was really good. They're a dangerous club. Also on Friday, every Friday, you will get Carry the 10, which is my column at CBSSports.com. And I've said it before, but I'll say it again. I've never been treated better than by the people at CBS Sports. They're awesome. Serge, Port, EK, Jeff, everybody. Igor, RJ, goes on and on and on. A great group of people, and I could not be luckier. And by the way, today is my birthday. I am years old. So feeling very thankful to be gainfully employed. And yeah, thanks for all of the good stuff. And thank you to listen. Thank you for all of you for listening to this podcast. And here you go. It is the next episode with Jonah Carey Podcast with Rich Griffin. Enjoy. Jonah Carey is on the phone. Voice proclivities might be, and now we're recording because we just jumped in. That's it. We ambushed the guest. It's very rude. Rich Griffin, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And your background is very interesting. Of course, you've been the longtime columnist for the Toronto Star, but then also you were the longtime public relations man, public relations ace, I think that's what they say, with the Montreal Expos.
Some do, some don't.
Some do, some don't. And
my wife doesn't, but that's
well.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I assume, like, I get that. So there's only, you know, a lot of journey questions asked and so forth. But one, I just wrote a story for CBS Sports about the 22 inning game, about this game that was 1-0. The Dodgers won it. Upi got ejected. All this stuff, and you and I had been meaning to chat about it. My deadline came and went, and you were busy, whatever. But you said that you have the final authority, the final story on this ridiculous game, so I want to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was the 17th inning when it could have ended, except Bob Davidson stood at third base on a sacrifice fly. Larry Walker scored.
What? So there was the Murray incident and there was the Walker incident. I think Walker was 16 and Murray was 18.
Okay, 16. Yeah. And everyone was leaving the field except Bob Davidson was standing at third base.
Which you do not do.
Staring at the bag as if something was going on. And, of course, Lasorda and the Dodger dugout reacts, and the last guys don't leave the field. They appeal the play at third base. And he's out. It's a double play. And so now it goes later in the game. Now it's in the 21st inning.
Uh-huh.
And Buck Rogers is looking for someone to pitch. And the only guy left is Joe Hesketh. And Joe Hesketh's going, oh, I got a little twinge here. I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can do it. How can you say I don't think I can do it when you're the last guy?
Yeah.
So Dennis Martinez gets his spikes, puts his spikes on. I guess he had pitched just a couple days before. And he goes to Buck and he says, I'll pitch. And he goes out and he pitches. Pitches one shutout, gives up the Dempsey home run. Game's over. The next day, that's a 6-hour and 14-minute game.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, we're meeting at the airport to fly to L.A., and Joe Hesketh arrives in a cab with his luggage, and John Silverman meets him on the sidewalk and says, don't bother taking your luggage out of the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the DL.
Mm-hmm.
You're not coming to the West Coast. So there was L.A., San Diego, San Francisco, Hesketh on the DL, obviously spitefully because Buck Rogers didn't like the fact that he was not available to pitch. And it's like, up yours, buddy. You're staying home. And that's what I remember. Plus the fact that I mentioned later on that the flight was shorter than the game and nobody scored on the flight either. Because that was a thing, you know?
Yes, back in those days. Joe Hesketh missed out on the beach, missed out on the Pacific Beach and Malibu and all that
stuff. And he's from Lackawanna, New York. And
he would have enjoyed it.
He would have enjoyed it, is correct.
Wow, Buck Rogers. I love all that stuff. And you know, even before we started talking, just figuring out. Because I honestly, if you were the PR guy for the Columbus Blue Jackets or the Cincinnati Reds, I just think there's something very interesting about that role. I've come to befriend some PR people over the years. Some younger folks now are coming into it. It feels more buttoned down now. Maybe all of society is more buttoned down now than it was then. And it's not, hey, I'm going to tell you these crazy stories or this, that. Not that I'm looking for anything salacious or anything. But now it feels like it's managing this, it's managing that. You know, when you're jumping into it, you're a young buck at that point when you got in late 70s, right?
1973, but took over in 1977 when my boss, the guy who hired me,
yeah,
Larry Chaisson, he passed away with leukemia in the middle of the 77 season.
Wow.
And they were looking for some older French-Canadian to take over, and they ended up with a young Anglophone taking over. So that was a difficulty. But yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah. And at that point, you know, if it's managing and just kind of making sure that everything goes smoothly and professionally, now you feel more like putting out fires then?
Well, back then, I feel proud of the fact that there was a generation of PR guys before I came along.
Yeah.
It was traveling secretaries on the road doing the game notes and doing the stats every day on and the stats were always wrong, you know, because the traveling secretary, everybody was out late, and then you'd have to either get home and do it or do it early in the morning. Stats were always wrong. And I felt like I was part of the generation along with guys like Ned Colletti.
Yeah.
Who was with the Cubs, then went on to be a successful executive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there was a generation there in the late 80s and early 90s who put personality back into the job of PR director or media relations director, because before that it was just like churn out the notes, churn out the stats, and that was it. And so when I won the Robert O. Fischel Award in 93, it was the year after Ned Colletti had won it, we took a certain pride. And it was in my acceptance speech where 8 of the women from the Expo's front office came up and gave me flowers on stage. That was wonderful.
Cool.
that was fabulous. And I gave the speech about the change in the job. And I think now, as you point out, it's returned to the corporate thing, because corporations that own teams want to be safe, and they don't want personalities doing this. And so it was a window, and I think I was a big part of that window introducing it.
How does one even get into this vocation? Was it something you thought about in school? Was it, I mean, you're a sports fan, I'm going to gather? I think now you can pretty much major in something like that. I don't know that you could in the early 70s.
I think I learned more from a 3-minute inning than I ever learned in school.
Yeah. You know? Same, by the way. Yeah.
But I dropped out of Concordia University. I was at Loyola High School.
Yep.
Went to Concordia the year that it changed to, and you know, I played junior varsity basketball against guys like Pat Hickey, who's with.
Wait, you probably played. How old are you?
I'm 63.
So my dad is just turned 68. So no, but he played with Hickey and John Doerr.
Yeah, John Doerr was one of my heroes. I was in high school. He was in college. He was at Loyola College before it became Concordia.
Yeah, those are my dad's teammates.
Randy Phillips with the Gazette played on this Sir George Williams team with Pat Hickey. So, like, I dropped out of school, and I got a summer job doing stats with the Expos because I needed the work, and I loved baseball.
Yeah.
And so I scored all the games in the Jerry Park press box. Scored all the games on the road off radio. That's why Dave Van Horn is my favorite broadcaster ever, because he and I became friends. Because I would ask for, like, if I missed something, I would ask to see the scorebook, but I never missed anything. I listened to every game for 4 years on the road before I started traveling.
Wow.
And I came up with this scoring system, which is unique to myself. And that's why when the stats geeks say you're an old school, hey, I was supplying stats in 1973 to 1980 for Jim Fanning, John McHale, for arbitration cases. I was a geek.
Absolutely.
And that was what set me apart in the minds of the Expos front office, is that I was willing to do this, willing to listen to every game, never missed a day.
Yeah.
And, you know, that work ethic plus an imagination plus a love of baseball all combined to overcome the fact that I was a college dropout.
Yeah.
And made a career out of it, made two careers out of it.
You sure did. I want to ask you about Jerry Park because I just missed it. I was born in 74. I could have gone, I guess, if somebody had taken me as an infant or a toddler, but I didn't get there. And for people who don't know, maybe they're, you know, new to the podcast or whatever, probably most people know that I'm an Expos homer, but Jerry Park was so weird. If you don't, you know the story, but it was a municipal park. It was like a couple bleachers where they played semi-pro ball. And then the Major League Baseball basically said, no, they awarded a team to Montreal. That was already a shocker. And then they said, okay, you've got 8 months to build a stadium. So they've got these bleachers, and they're going to turn it into 30,000-seat stadium, which is going to be at least sort of adequate, or that's the goal. And then they played there. They're supposed to play for 3 years. They played there for eight years. So how rickety was this place? Was it charming or was it just shitty?
It was charmingly shitty.
Charmingly shitty.
I mean, basically,
like the Expos of that era, by the way.
Basically, I remember we always celebrated August 14th, 1968, as the official birth of the Montreal Expos, because Charles Bronfman and his partners, and Charles was a late arrival, and Russ Taylor and a couple of the guys figured out that Jerry Park was a last-ditch locale. And when Jerry Park was approved by the commissioner, then they were able to make the payment, which was August 14th, $1 million down payment on a $10 million franchise fee. That's crazy.
Yes, it's crazy.
$1 million down.
Even if you adjust for inflation, it's so crazy.
And then they're going to open on April the 8th of 69.
That's right.
So the
team, you have 8 months.
That's it. You have less. And so they put all these aluminum seats in, not thinking about the sun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sun is that thing that comes up in the morning and goes down around game time.
Even in Canada, you still have the sun.
goes down around game time.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, quirky, you had a 2-week period in June, maybe late June, where Ron Fairley would not play first base between 7:30 and 8:15.
And why is that?
And because the sun between the bleachers and the stands would be going down and shining right in his eyes. And he had this thing called a survival instinct.
And if the shortstop threw at him, what would happen to that, Rich?
It would hit him right between the eyes.
That's right.
Tim Foley and a couple of, you know, Tim Foley's arm was pretty strong and pretty accurate, and those eyes were his target.
Of course.
But there was that. And then just the fact that these were aluminum seats with the sun reflecting off these aluminum seats. The first baseman wasn't the only one blinded by the light. And you had seats facing in the wrong direction. If you're down the lines, you're facing the outfielder on your side of the field, and you got to look that way to see home plate. So there was nothing charming about it. The only charming part was after games, all the media and Gene Mock and his coaches and the visiting coaches would come up to this private lounge under a beam on the third level of Jerry Park on the third base side, and they would serve drinks until 4 in the morning. They had a private bartender. It was a private club. Gene Mock and his coaches. Gene didn't hang around very long, especially after a loss, because he was not a good loser. Yes. I mean, that was one of the things my early years in 73 to 76, when 75 when Gene was fired, and they played a lot of doubleheaders. My job was to go down between games of the doubleheader and get the second game's lineup from Gene. And I was a kid, and I was scared shitless of going into his office and saying, "Mr. Mock, do you have the second game lineup?" When they lost, like, he's flipping over food tables and he's MFing everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm a kid. So I think that that hardened me a little to the reality stuff of what baseball, Major League Baseball, really is. But Jerry Park, I would drive my Honda 125 from Montreal West, and I'd go park in the parking lot, and I'd leave 4 in the morning on my Honda 125.
Yeah.
And they taught me how to love baseball, respect the game, and drink heavily. Three keys to life.
You could definitely make that argument. You mentioned Mock. You mentioned Van Horn. Van Horn's still going strong. God bless him. Who are some of the other characters that stand out for you? Maybe on the player side, maybe in the administrative side, because they're just, again, some of these are names to me and not necessarily fully formed personalities. As a historian, as somebody who, you know, tries to dabble away at writing about events of the past, I don't really know. I wasn't there.
Well, one of my favorite people, and you probably never heard of him from the Jerry Park years, was a guy named Roger Savard. Okay. Roger Savard weighed about 325 pounds and was a do-everything guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a bombardier during World War II, was a POW in Germany. So he was a tough guy.
Yeah.
And I remember he was assigned to make sure that in the 1982 All-Star Game that there was a good representation of Montreal Expos in that game. And if you recall, it was
five of them.
Four
started.
And the deal was there was no online voting. Uh-huh. Everything was in the ballpark.
Uh-huh. I know where this is going.
And Roger came up with a factory that had power drills, and he got over a million ballots and just power drilled.
Come on!
Power drilled through Gary Carter, Al Arbor, all Rains,
Steve Dawson.
Rogers was
a pitcher, but yeah. But he deserved it. Rogers was great, too. Yeah.
So basically, from Olympic Stadium, you could hold up these ballots and see the Jacques Cartier Bridge through the Gary Carter hole, because it was front to back. And the deal was that there was a deadline where all these ballots had to be submitted, but Roger didn't want everyone to know what was going on. So he got a cube van, piled all these fixed ballots into the cube van, and he rode shotgun while one of his employees drove. They drove down to New Jersey, where they were counting it like 10 minutes before a deadline, and said, "We got all these ballots." And they pulled them out, and they're like, and the commissioner actually was asked to make a decision on it, and stories never come out, and everybody talks about the cities that have stuffed the ballot. And I always sit back and go, oh. And I tell the story, but nobody listens, you know? And the commissioner decided Montreal, small market team, hosting the game, to hell with it. Let's let them have the ballot, you know? And then there's all those famous photos on the field of all the starting guys together.
Yeah.
Jim Fanning and Steve Rogers. And I every time I see one of those photos, I go, this is great. If only people knew.
Nobody wrote about this? It was never made public?
Nobody wrote about it because I think it was done very well by Roger, who passed away probably in, before I left the Expos. It was probably mid-80s he passed away.
Yeah.
It was one of the greatest accomplishments in terms of, well, now it cheating like that is... when you're allowed to vote 10 times online per day or whatever.
No, this would be the social media scandal and whatnot. Well, wait a minute. Do we have to go back and re-adjudicate the game? Has Gary Matthews been hosed? Like, should we feel remorse for the people that were left on the sidelines? Leon Durham?
Well, you could do that, but the game is full of incidents like that. So let's just let that one go.
That's incredible. Oh, my God. That's so good. So you're going along over the years... and the team got good. I mean, you know, to take over full-time 77, that's the first year of the Big O, first of all. Well, you know what? Even before we get to that. I have all day. Give me all
the stories. Before, this is just as I'm starting out. Larry Chaisson was still in the hospital. I was sort of taking charge.
Yeah.
And this has become my mantra of making decisions. I'm there in the PR office. It's at the back of the parking lot at the time. They hadn't built real offices, so we're in the parking lot breathing in carbon monoxide all day. And this is 77, 78. And there's somebody comes to reception, and they call me out. And it's the great Antonio. The great Antonio is an Eastern European strongman who wants to, between games of a doubleheader, wrestle a bear on the field.
They didn't milk cows on the field.
Right,
so wasn't that weird, but
well,
still
that was
weird.
My first great note is that we were trying to ward off PETA because they were bringing the farm animals down in a cube van with no windows, no air.
Oh, boy.
And Pepe Frias was the greatest pig chaser, you know, grease pig chaser.
Uh-huh.
But the pig died.
No!
So we were worried about PETA. So in the game notes, I wrote that that the pig... pulled a hamstring.
Oh my God.
And that Pepe would not be chasing a pig. At least until later.
By the way, hamstring, the greatest inadvertent pun, possibly vertent pun of all time.
Yes. And so the great Antonio is at the switchboard, and I've got an audience of people watching me interview this guy because he's in like a leopard skin loincloth.
Yes.
And he's probably late in his career. He looked like he was in his 50s or 60s.
Mm. He wasn't an Abercrombie model.
No. The great Antonio, strongman, Eastern European. He was on the wrestling circuit at one point. And he wants to wrestle a bear between games of a doubleheader. And I'm just 23 years old, and I'm going, I don't think this is a good idea. So the question that became my mantra is, what if you lose? He had no answer except that he drugged the bear heavily. He said,
wow.
But that's whenever I come up to a question that you really don't want to go in one direction, I think of, what if you lose? And that's my great Antonio incident. That shaped my career as a PR guy.
This isn't that long ago. You know, to think of this era... you know, we think of who are the big characters in Major, like Yasiel Puig is a character. Yasiel Puig is absolutely a character. But he's a character because he poses on Instagram doing funny stuff. I mean, these people, like, the cow milking thing.
Woody Fryman.
Yeah, Woody Fryman, Larry Parrish, but Fryman was unbeatable. It just wasn't that long ago. You'd never have cows on the... although... did any other team do that? Maybe I'm thinking of it wrong. Maybe it's not
No, no, it wasn't strictly...
Was it strictly Montreal?
Montreal.
Okay.
No, this was an era of kids coming up to play baseball off the farm, so it was a natural.
Yeah.
But we made a bigger deal out of it.
Well, because Woody was so good at it.
Yeah, Woody was a farm. He owned cows.
Yeah. I just, that kind of stuff just amazes me. So if you're vetting a promoter, okay, so let's say the cows are more frequent, bears are less frequent. If you're, were you the one in charge of vetting that kind of stuff? Or that'd be like the promotion?
But that was promotion department. Yeah. But this guy specifically, I'm not sure if he asked for me, but he asked for the PR guys.
Wow.
So that was that.
Friends, we've got a terrific, terrific sponsor on today's podcast, and that is MeUndies. They are outstanding, unbelievably comfortable, terrific. I love them. They have sent me pairs, and I can report back. They're the best underwear I have ever worn. Fantastic. It's made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric, 3 times softer than cotton, which seems mathematically impossible, but true. It's the ultimate feel-good undies. 100% satisfaction guarantee. They guarantee that you will love them or your money back. And right now, MeUndies has an exclusive offer just for listeners of the podcast. You can get 20% off your first pair plus free shipping. MeUndies is so sure you will love your underwear. They even offer the 100% satisfaction guarantee to go along with it. So it's a no-brainer to try. 20% off, free shipping, 100% satisfaction guarantee. What are you waiting for? Here is how you do it. To get 20% off, free shipping, and 100% satisfaction guarantee of the best, softest underwear you will ever own, go to MeUndies.com. That's MeUndies.com/JKP, as in Jonah Carey Podcast. That's MeUndies.com/JKP. It's a limited time offer, so you better get on this. The most comfortable underwear of your life. MeUndies.com/JKP.
Oh, there's another one. I don't want to interrupt, but you were asking.
No, there is no interrupt. This is what the podcast is about. It's literally about telling stories.
But I think that, you know, you talked about the great years that the Expos had. And,
yeah.
And you know, as youngsters, I joined the Expos in 73. And you sort of glamorize. And those 69 to 73 teams were not very good.
Although 73, they were oddly contending because it was the worst division ever.
But now you're talking, you're getting into Jerry Park, you're getting into Dick Williams coming on board.
Young talent getting developed on the farm.
Young talent, it was phase two, Mel Didier is phase two.
Yeah.
And these guys started to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get to that whole decade, which was spoiled by the Bill Verdon years, because Bill Verdon was the
worst,
grumpiest old man I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. But the rookie years of Larry Walker, Marquis Grissom, Delino DeShields, and that was tremendous. That was with Dennis Martinez. That was a great young pitching
late
staff
80s, early 90s,
led by Dennis Martinez. So it's now 1990, and it's April or early May, and Larry Walker is a platoon outfielder.
Mm-hmm.
So now Mark Gardner and Larry Walker hung out a lot. And I hung out with them. You know, that was back in the days when players would go, "Oh, there's Rich." Now they go, "Oh, there's Rich."
Yeah,
You change sides and all of a sudden you change sides.
Which, by the way, how and why? I mean, is that just the professionalism thing?
That's just the professional aspect of it. Yeah, I'm still the same guy.
Right.
You know, I haven't grown up. And
I hope you don't. None of us should.
So now, Lindsay. We're in Atlanta, and we're in Atlanta in April or May, first road trip. Larry Walker is strictly a platoon outfielder at this time.
Bad knees. He's only facing.
He had that 1 year off, and he said, I kept being quoted as saying, "Oh, Larry's doing fine. He's recovering." And Larry would go, "Who the hell is this guy? He keeps talking about me. I've never met him." So anyway, we had met by this time.
Mm-hmm.
We're in Atlanta. We're in Buckhead. There's a bar. All I remember is there's a bar with a huge tree growing out of the middle of the bar.
Okay.
And it's outdoors, obviously, and we're there. And I go, "Walk, you think we should go? Gardner's not pitching the next day." Mm-hmm. And Walk goes, "No, there's a left-hander pitching. I'm not playing. Let's stay."
Yeah.
So we stayed till like 4 in the morning. We stayed so late that I climbed the tree.
That's athleticism.
Now we get, it was a gnarly tree. It had lots of gnarly.
Uh-huh.
So now we get to the ballpark, the old Fulton County Stadium.
A hole. Worse than the Big O.
So I'm looking at the lineup, and Walker's hitting sixth. And it's Steve Avery pitching.
Oh, who was really good when he came up.
And I go into the training room, and Walker's on the training table with a towel over his head. I go, Walk, you see the lineup? Yes. and like, second at bat, he hits a three-run bomb to left center field.
Yeah.
And after the game, I'm going, he's back on the training table after the game. I go, Walk, maybe we should do this every day. And he goes, I don't think so. And Walker's another guy, to me, that never grew up. I mean, he's a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
He went to Colorado, and there's a story. I mean, I knew enough stories about him that when I saw that he had been going fishing at 5 in the morning and he fell down the hill into the lake and hurt his ankle, I'm going, yeah, right. Because this fishing. Is the guy. This uh-huh. is the guy that really never grew up. But imagine how good he would have been and the numbers he would have put up if there hadn't been work stoppages. If he had taken it more seriously, yeah. And he took it seriously enough where he was. Larry Walker was the best instinctive defensive outfielder yep. that I've ever seen, except when he handed the ball to that kid
at Dodger Stadium '92, I think.
But that was because management in all teams and management with the Expos had said, okay, guys, we're having labor issues. You know, we got a pending strike in mm-hmm. a couple of years. We got this and that. We want you to be more fan-friendly. Sign more autographs and whatever. So he catches the ball, fan-friendly, hands it to yeah. the kid, and then goes to get it and throws a guy out at the plate. Unfortunately, the damage was done.
Yes, that was Game of the Week, too, and the Expos were never on the game. It was the ESPN Game of the Week at that time.
I think it was the Dodgers were on the Game of the Week.
But the Expos, they were playing. That was the thing. That was shocking. Well, and Walker, and this, again, this is all secondhand. I was not old enough, whatever, but like in the course of my reporting, I talked to other guys in that era, the Shields and all these guys. Most instinctive outfielder, they said best base runner, and his background was, he played hockey. You know, he's a hockey player from BC, and he liked baseball, but he just, you know, there's guys you hear about, these gym rats, these guys are just, they're obsessed with it or whatever. And I mean this as a compliment and not an insult. He wasn't that guy because he didn't feel like it should be an all-consuming part of his life. That was one thing that he did, and he was also this guy, and he had a personality and whatever. And I thought how admirable that is. So I sort of get it. Like, yeah, if he did more Stairmaster or bench presses or whatever, maybe. But that was what made Walker Walker. He was supernaturally talented, and he didn't let baseball be everything about his life.
Yeah, he would not have gone towards baseball if he hadn't been cut as a goaltender. He wanted to be a hockey player,
right.
But he's cut as a goaltender. He's seen at a tryout camp by one of the Expo scouts, and at the time there was no draft for Canadian kids, so they just signed him and
for like 10 cents.
He's the reason that they put Canadians in the draft because of his signing, and they went, oh, that's not fair. There's two Canadian teams. And they're the only ones who get to see him. Well, why?
That didn't happen until the 90s?
Till late 80s, yeah.
Wow.
And so anyway, Walker goes to the New York Penn League,
uh-huh.
and Jim Fanning's doing part of that, and Pat Doherty was a manager at Jamestown,
mm-hmm.
and they can't find a position for this guy. They try him at third base, they try him at first base. He's just a hitter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I always find it amazing that he became such a great outfielder and because he was such a great athlete.
Yeah.
You know, and when I was covering the World Series in St. Louis, where Walker, his last shot at a championship.
Yeah.
And Scott Rolen said, he is the best teammate I've ever had. And Scott Rolen's a veteran guy, and Scott Rolen would be on that list of best teammates that anyone's ever had. And when he said that, I felt that it vindicated my own feeling. And I thought, well, maybe I'm prejudiced and biased because I was with him for mm-hmm. so many years. But to hear Scott Rolen say that, for whom I had the ultimate respect, that was a tremendous thing to hear about Larry Walker. And it's funny how, you know, the numbers are translate in some ways, in many ways, to Hall of Fame numbers.
But by the advanced stats, he's good enough to be a Hall
of Famer. People go, oh, well, Colorado played at Mile High and whatever. Yeah, he's one of my favorite players and one of my favorite people, too.
He was Raines was my initial favorite player, but when Walker came up, and people who know my craziness know this, but he became the next generation best of my favorite player. Go ahead.
And then the thing about Walker is that he had the misfortune of being the first great Canadian player in a province that wanted to separate from Canada at the time.
Yes.
So that was unfortunate.
But they would boo the national anthem, the Canadian national anthem at Montreal Expos games in the, you know, early to mid-90s.
Well, this is a story that relates to that.
Yes, go ahead.
But it was St. Jean-Baptiste Day, and marketing had sold the entire upper deck to the St. Jean-Baptiste Society.
Wow.
And they were going to finish their parade at home plate.
So St. Jean-Baptiste, for people who are listening who don't know this, it is a holiday in Quebec, and it is meant, there's a little bit of, like, nationalism involved. June 24th. The idea is to celebrate the heritage of, I don't want to say pure land, but it's definitely a certain kind of hometown, Quebec province kind of thing. And, you know, you get used to it if you're Anglo or Franco or whatever, but it can be contentious.
Yeah, it's populated by separatist feelings about getting nine provinces plus the country of Quebec.
That's correct. And there was a referendum in 1995, right, and the country very nearly separated.
So Walker, unfortunately, comes to Montreal at a time when this is boiling over.
Yes, it is.
And marketing department, I would say God bless them, but I don't, because I didn't appreciate this, sold the entire upper deck at Olympic Stadium to the St. Jean-Baptiste Society, and they were going to finish their parade at home plate.
Mm-hmm.
But the only stipulation was that there was no Canadian national anthem played that night. And marketing went along with it.
What? They didn't play the Canadian national anthem?
No, here's the deal. We're out for early BP at 3 in the afternoon, and Walker's leaning on the cage. I'm leaning on the cage talking to him. All of a sudden, they're playing the Canadian national anthem at 3 in the afternoon.
So they could check it off the list.
And like, Walker's going, what the? And I explained to him about they sold this and that. And they sort of snuck through. Nobody noticed that the anthem wasn't played before the game. Wow. And this is where the difference between PR guys now and PR guys back then.
Yeah.
I told certain of our media, I said, you should go ask Larry Walker about the anthem. And they went
to F with Walker, basically?
Walker knew I was going to do it because he wanted to talk about it.
Oh, he did? Okay, all right.
Yeah, so I went and told some Anglophone, mostly media members, and they went and talked to him. It was a big story.
Yeah.
And then that sort of made Walker more popular with some, less popular with others. But it also made him less popular with the marketing department and the front office. And that's sort of in the wheelhouse of when he fell out of favor with guys like Kevin Malone and Dan Duquette and those guys as general managers.
Huh.
And
because he was too vocal?
Yeah, he was too vocal. Huh. And he liked to poke him with a stick and be even more vocal. If they said, you're too vocal, he would become more vocal.
Well, his nickname was Booger. He was the guy who would, like, I mean, if we're going to be slightly off color, he would, like, hold somebody's head in the hot tub and, like, pass gas and, like, just kind of bug people. Like, he was an agitator, right?
Not in
a bad way.
Yeah, no, I think the biggest aspect of Booger was that he could burp the national anthem and you could understand it.
Yes.
And that was my older boy, who's now 32 and managing Guelph University.
Yeah.
That was the thing that fascinated him about Larry Walker. Larry burped the national anthem for my son Matthew at spring training.
Wow!
And to this day, he'll talk about, yeah. Larry Walker burped the national anthem. Or not the national anthem, the alphabet.
Yeah,
A to Z.
Yeah.
And that was tremendous, is in my son's mind. And that was the Booger more than any of the other stuff. He was an agitator,
yeah,
but he was a great teammate and a great friend to everybody in that clubhouse.
Wow. That's great stuff. So I also want to ask you about, just in the era, half an hour before that, about the Gary Carter thing. And Carter's no longer around. We don't speak ill of people who are not around and so forth. But I always found that interesting as an outsider, because once, you know, I got older and became aware of all this stuff, Carter was the fan favorite of all fan favorites. I'm not sure that there was any player who was more popular with his team than Carter was right in that era, 79 to 82. I mean, like, a god. Swarm, autographs, smiling, this, that, the other. And there was a disconnect because he would get paid more than play. I mean, there were a couple players in particular who were as good as he was, and they're both in the Hall of Fame now. And he would get much more attention. He would get much more positive attention. And they gave him this nickname, Lights. All the lights come on, there goes Gary Carter. from a fan perspective, you're like, great. Why would I not want the Gretzky of my team, the Michael Jordan of my team on camera? And from the teammates' perspective, they're like, that guy. How did you perceive it? Was there a real schism in the clubhouse about it?
Well, at the time, and this is going to take like a period of about 15 years to explain.
Okay.
But in those early years when he came up, he was a kid. That was his nickname. Yes. He was a kid. I mean, they played tricks on him, like at spring training. He would see a McDonald's on a road trip on the bus, and he'd want to go get a burger, and then the other guys would say, let's go, and the bus would leave, and Gary would be there with his two bags.
And he's a future Hall of Famer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Future Hall of Famer. Yeah. But the thing is that the lights thing, I mean, he was unaware of what he was doing. He was trying so hard to be one of the guys.
Yeah.
You know, and he's from Culver City, and he's like a middle-class kid. And
quite Christian, yeah, and observant.
Yeah, absolutely.
And strong, very clean, straight arrow, yeah. Especially by standards of that era.
So some of the stuff that he did, he didn't know was rubbing his teammates the wrong way. Right. Like, you know, I should let you know that the first million-dollar player for the Expos was Andre Dawson. It was not Gary Carter.
Right. Carter got that when he got the 10-year contract. That's when people freaked out. But Dawson Dawson was great and got paid. But you're right.
But Gary Carter got all the endorsements, got all the advertising money, got all the local pub. He lived there all year round with Sandy and the kids. And so, yeah, he was a god. He was a hero with the fans. But it seemed like everything he tried rubbed players the wrong way. There was one time... overnight, I was downstairs after the game. Everybody left. And these guys from Penman's come in, and that was one of Gary's deals. And they had cheap plastic chairs in front of every locker. And so Gary had a deal where everyone got a director's chair with the nice comfortable seat in the back, the blue back, and there were no names on them because they were interchangeable.
Yeah.
The only thing is that Gary's seat was red and everybody else's was blue and his had his name on the back. And the players went, oh, great, we got seats. Lights has his red one so everybody knows who got the seat.
Doug Flynn's really pissed off.
Yeah.
Somebody pissed off.
And it was that sort of thing. And when he found out that there was feedback on that, a negative feedback on his gesture, it hurt him deeply. And you know, there's other stuff like I mean, people don't know that he had like 8 flap tears of his knee that he played through. Mm-hmm. And he'd have to manipulate it with his fingers just to get into game. So there was a doubleheader, and he was asked to catch the second game of the doubleheader, and Charlie Lee was pitching.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went, and he's in the clubhouse, and he's going, I don't want to catch. You know, I caught the first game, my knee's hurting. Second game, Charlie Lee pitches a no-hitter. Yes. And, of course, the clubhouse doors open up, all the media comes in, and they head right to Gary's locker because Charlie's getting some treatment in the back. And the rest of the team's watching as Gary's talking about, you know, how he loved catching both ends of the doubleheader. And he knew that Charlie had his good stuff today and all that stuff. And here's where you leap forward, you jump forward to after Gary Carter's retired. He's won a championship with the Mets. He's retired. And he gets together with teammates, Expos teammates, and they realize that Gary Carter has not changed. He's still the kid. He's still the same guy. Mm-hmm. And it's the first time that guys like Warren Cromartie, Dawson Raines realized, why were we mad at this guy? This is who he is. This is who he is. This is what he is. And he became one of the guys only after his career was over because of the fact that he had never changed. He was still the kid, still said some silly stuff, like when Carlton Fisk was about to be voted into the Hall of Fame and Gary had been on the ballot already for 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. I talked to him on the phone. I said, Gary, last couple of years, you've been not very gracious when you haven't been voted into the Hall of Fame. I know you're a Hall of Famer. There's a lot of voters. There's like 65-70% of the voters know you're a Hall of Famer. So be more gracious. Fisk will probably go in this year. Mm-hmm. Be gracious when he goes in. And so Cotton Fitz got voted in, and I'm reading quotes, and it's, you know, I should have been in this year. And I was the National League's Cotton Fisk. I was Johnny Bench's successor, and he was. All those things are true. But what happened to the be more gracious? You know? Because he was a kid, he was Gary, and we all love him now and then.
Yeah.
And his teammates understood him after his career was over. So when they talk about what a great guy Gary was, they are telling the absolute truth, but it took them a while to find out.
Yeah.
Hey, are you 0-2 in your fantasy league? It's quite possible. This has happened to a lot of people. I've got a solution for you. How about FanDuel? FanDuel's a great way to do it. You can do it week by week, and you don't have to worry necessarily about busted seasons. And you can go to FanDuel.com, click the Join Now button, and use the promo code Jonah. That's J-O-N-A-H. And you will get all kinds of goodies. It's fantasy football for everyday fans. New contest starting every week. Again, no busted seasons. It's something for everyone with lots of contests to choose from. Starts at a buck. Pick a contest. Choose your team. Watch your score real time. More than 2.5 million players have won a cash prize playing fantasy sports on FanDuel. New users get free entry into the NFL Sunday Million with more than $1 million in cash prizes on the line when you make your first deposit on FanDuel. So just visit FanDuel.com. That's FanDuel.com. Sign up with the promo code Jonah today. Thank you to FanDuel for sponsoring the podcast.
Well, and the point about the Expos, and maybe there was some acrimony there, much more pronounced on the Mets, because that was one of the biggest groups of ne'er-do-wells that ever lived, the 86 Mets. Here comes this guy, this Christian straight-shooter guy, and you got Dykstra, you got Strawberry and Goodman, all these guys. There's all kinds of stuff happening, and when Carter passes away, they interviewed Daryl Strawberry on FAN, and they ask him about, you know, various things, and they ask him about Carter, and he starts crying. And, you know, at first they're thinking that he's crying because, wow, his beloved ex-teammate passed away. He was crying because they treated him like garbage, because they thought that this guy's like a narc, like, who's this square and whatever. And Strawberry said he was better than the rest of us. He was a good dude. He was righteous in the good meaning of the word righteous. And they just didn't see it. And, you know, some of them, maybe Cromartie and them, figured it out and they got back together. And some of them, like, he passed away. Maybe they never got to reconcile. That sucks.
And I just remember driving across at spring training for Gary's memorial service in North Palm Beach.
Yeah.
And just being amazed, not only at the number of people that showed up, but the different proportion of former Expo teammates that were there to former Mets teammates. And the Expo teammates triple the number of Mets teammates. And Port St. Lucie's right there.
Yeah.
And I sort of felt good about that, you know?
There was something formative about it for sure. So 95, 4, 5, what was your last year?
The strike happened in 94, August 11th, 94. We were in the clubhouse in Pittsburgh. We had a meeting before a game with the Pirates. Kevin Malone, Felipe, telling the boys, hang by your phone, stay in shape. We're going to be back in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, that was the feeling.
We will be back. And so that was, I was there as the PR guy. Then as the winter went along, as the winter of baseball winter, as the baseball winter went along after the World Series, they had me, I was already doing games on radio.
Yep.
I think I did 35 a year on radio, color guy, and doing play-by-play also.
Very unusual, by the way, for a PR. I mean, that was not, still not a thing, really.
Yeah. Especially since I was still doing the PR stuff. You know?
I guess that could be perceived as a conflict of interest, I suppose.
But I was entertaining.
That's good.
But, so after the season, they had me going in, or during the strike, actually, they had me going in and doing a talk show. Because I did a talk show from till midnight after home games that last season, the last two seasons. And I still owe a bunch of players parting gifts.
Yeah, right.
Which I never got.
Where's your Longines Wittenauer or whatever of the game?
So it was during the strike, and Claude Brochu was trying to downplay, and he was trying to keep staff on. But he laid off the traveling secretary, Eric Osling, who lived next to me in Pointe Claire. And I had got him the job. He was my neighbor, and he needed a job, and he worked his way up. He worked hard and did that. So they lay him off, and they want me to do the traveling secretary and the PR.
Mm.
And they said, well, you still do the broadcasts.
You got young kids at this point, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you still do the talk show till midnight. And they said that, the talk show till midnight, traveling show, that's enough. And they weren't going to give me any more money.
Wow.
So I would be taking money out of the pocket of
yep.
the traveling secretary and a broadcaster
mm-hmm.
and doing all this work and getting no extra money. So the challenge was there. He had a meeting. Brochu had a meeting with the staff, the remaining staff, and said, I hear there's some discontent in this front office, and I'll have you know that you still get free coffee, you get a parking space, and you have a job, and unemployment in Quebec is at 19.5%. And everybody looked at each other and went, free coffee? Wow. I never thought about it like that. I'm in. So that was when I sort of started looking around, and the stars, baseball columnist job opened up. Dave Perkins had been doing it.
Perkins, for people don't know, quite a very accomplished Canadian journalist.
And he was the baseball columnist during the 92-93 World Series years, 94 for the strike year. Then he went on to be the sports editor, so he was hiring his own replacement.
Yeah.
And so Michael Farber recommended me. If you have that as a recommendation, you got
nobody better.
You moved to the front of the line. You know, sure they wanted did. Mike, but he was happy where he was.
SI at that time,
and in Quebec with his French Canadian wife.
Uh-huh.
But that was basically my last year and why I left. And people thought, well, you're bailing out because there was a referendum later that year.
There was in 95. Yeah.
And no, I wasn't bailing out. I was being challenged, and. In fact, Claudine Cook, who now works for the Lou Gehrig Society in Montreal, in Quebec, she runs it. She quit the same day I did. She went in to Claude Brochu's office late January of 95 during the strike. And she went in, unbeknownst to me, she went in and quit. And Claude Brochu said, Claudine, we'd love you to stay. What would it take to get you to stay? We really want you to stay. We'll give you more money. We'll give you more responsibility. So she comes in and sits in my office, and she goes, oh, that was the toughest thing I've ever done. I just quit. I said, really? I'm going in right now to quit. So I wander in, and Claude stands up and says, shakes my hand. He says, very good decision. That's a good company. You can pack your stuff and go. I went, oh, I was expecting something else.
Yeah, there was no love sonnets.
There was nothing there. There was nothing. There was nothing left for me to do there. And I had priced myself out of that position. They just wanted somebody. And I'm not, P.J. Laiolo came in, who's now with the Marlins.
P.J. fantastic.
As a vice president.
Yeah.
He had been with the Ottawa
Lynx.
Mm-hmm. And he just moved in and took over, but at a much lower cost to the Expos.
Yeah.
I think that had a lot to do with it too. So I'm still a patriot, but a Canadian patriot.
You're definitely an Expos patriot, considering the events of Tim Raines' induction weekend, where we all had a lovely time. I want to wrap one more bow around the Expos stuff, which is for people who maybe they're a little younger, maybe they were a fan of Chicago White, so whatever it is, they don't quite realize how good were the 94 Expos.
Oh, the 94 Expos, the pitching staff.
Which doesn't get talked about as much. I feel like it's a lot of it is the outfield, the Walker, Grissom, and
the Luther. I mean, the bullpen had maybe four guys who were closers at the time or went on to be major league closers.
Rojas, yeah.
John Wetland was classic.
Killer.
And the next year he was the MVP of the World Series for the Yankees.
Yeah.
And it was a deep, strong bullpen. The rotation had great balance between lefties and righties.
Pedro was
who would all go six, seven, eight, 9 innings. And then the bullpen was so deep, they handed it off to them. But the highlight of that team's offense was built around the outfield.
Yes.
I mean, you look at those numbers through 108, 110 games, those are full season numbers for Marquise Grissom, Moises, and Larry Walker.
Yeah.
Those are full season numbers. And, you know, there was just offense everywhere. And these guys had pulled away from the Atlanta Braves. And that's why in 22 years writing, I've never mentioned that the Atlanta Braves won so many division titles in a row.
Correct.
It's not true.
That's right. And, you listening?
And the thing is that team was pulling away. That team was great. That team was deep. That team had offense, speed, defense, and most of all, deep, deep pitching.
Yeah.
And you know, I talk to Steve Rogers every April when he comes back, and every spring when he goes around with he works for the Players Association now as an executive there. And we talk about it, and he believes that the 80, not necessarily the 81, 80, 80, 182, those teams could play the 94 and beat them. And both those eras, like 79 to
they won 95
79
games
to 82, and 82 was 82 was a season where the Cardinals won the division and won the World Series. But for 4 years in a row, the team that beat the Expos won the World Series.
Pirates, Phillies, Dodgers,
And it was that was an era where you look at the youth on that on those teams and the pitching staff and the depth of the pitching staff. I think that 94 was great and 93 built into that.
Yeah.
But that other era was just as good.
It's interesting too. I mean, I don't want to go too far down the weeds, but the theory that I put forth in my book was it really came down to understanding the little things. Now, if you look at the Dodgers, for instance, this year, they're wonderful. Kershaw is wonderful. They're star Seager and Bellinger and all that. The Dodgers have no weaknesses. They could put in this kid Chris Taylor, and he's the best left fielder in the league. Their sixth reliever is really good. They've done a really good job of that. I don't know if baseball in general had quite figured out. This is a very, like, analytical, like, I need to be on point with this platoon. This backup shortstop needs to be this. Those teams failed in the late 70s and early 80s. Yeah, it was circumstance. They lost to so-and-so. They would skimp. They wouldn't have a good shortstop 1 year. They wouldn't have. They just were missing stuff. The 94 team was missing nothing. You know, you're platooning Cliff Floyd with Randy Milligan, who's hitting home runs off the lefties. Lenny Webster is coming in and doing things. Again, their fifth best reliever is really good. That was just a very. It felt like the 2016 Cubs. It felt like the 2017 Dodgers, where they just made sure that everything was on point.
Yeah, and to your point and agreeing with it.
Yeah.
In hindsight, I look back, and one of my favorite stats about those teams of 79 to 82 of the Expos was that 79 team. And the 79 team had great frontline players.
Yes.
I mean, you had
Hall of Famers.
Yeah, in 78, the outfield assists were 28, 22, and 15 with Cromartie, Valentine, and Dawson in center field.
Yeah.
They had 62 outfield assists among three guys. So in 79, to your point of depth and having a weakness here and there, the 79 Expos had one 15-day disablement all season. Hmm. Chris Spire, they used the All-Star break. They disabled Chris Spire on July the 4th. He missed the All-Star break of 3 days, came back. The only player, pitcher, position player, anybody that was on the DL, one player, 15 days. Now you look at these Blue Jays or any team, in Major League Baseball, and especially with the 10-day deal, which is a travesty.
It is.
And you got like 20, 25 guys over the course of the year going to be on the DL. And like, shouldn't these guys be better because of the training techniques and shouldn't these guys be healthier? And the other thing is, back in those days, guys would throw 7, 8, 9 innings. And now with peak performance guys, they're throwing like 6 and looking to the bullpen and 6 and 7. And I hate to sound like an old fart, but they should be better. They should be going deeper. They should be ready to go 12.
Yeah, but they're going full tilt in the first inning, which you didn't do back in. I mean, one of the seminal baseball books was written by freaking Christy Mathewson 100 years ago. And it's like, I'm going to sail through. And it was easier back then because you didn't have second baseman who could bop 40 home runs. But I'm going to pace myself or whatever. Marcus Stroman's not pacing himself. He's, first of all, the hitters he's going to face in the first inning are murderers, killers. There's no more 140-pound infielders anymore. And secondly, that's just what you've been told. And I mean, I agree with your point, But if you know that you have five Andrew Millers in the bullpen too, why are you trying to get cute? Just,
well, that's it.
The stats say the third time through the order is a big penalty, so don't even bother with the third time through the order, I guess.
But I love National League Baseball because of the use of the benches.
Yeah.
So all they have to do is, and I thought for sure someone would address it during this last negotiation, but they have to expand rosters. If you're going to carry
Any good pitch hitters anymore.
If you're going to carry 12, 13 pitchers, then you got to go back to having guys off the bench that can actually do something.
We don't have Lenny Harris. We don't have Wallace Johnson. Yeah, those guys don't exist.
Absolutely. Instead of having a backup catcher and one infielder and one outfielder, that makes no sense because you're never pinch hitting. You're never when the Blue Jays played at Wrigley Field.
Yeah,
that's the most joy I felt watching a series in a long, long time.
Yeah, the progression of Toronto sports I find interesting too, and obviously I focus more on baseball than hockey. But even that series, that Jays Cup series, because we knew the Jays fans traveled to Seattle because the Vancouver thing and Jays are now Canada's team or whatever. They were loud at Wrigley Field. Wrigley Field, the bastion, you know, great Cubs fans are fantastic. I mean, you could hear the Blue Jays fans. Is that all from the last couple of years, this resurgence of the team, or have Jays fans been particularly resonant or travel well or whatever? Because it's cool. It's cool to watch.
Yeah, and in fact, players that were there, even Blue Jays players and Cubs players, felt like it was a louder crowd than when St. Louis comes in, which tells you a lot about...
Wow, because that's the rivalry.
Yeah, that's the rivalry. But I think, I mean, I know that the July 31st trade deadline in 2015 made a huge difference, but I feel like when Paul Beeson brought back the old blue, the colors, and then all of these younger fans, this younger generation of fans that had been, during the Paul Godfrey and Gord Ash years, had been weaned on black uniforms, black and silver, and these are the Blue Jays. And so when Beeston brought back those uniforms and the team started to play well, all of a sudden there was a whole group of, I don't know what year the millennials start, but they travel well.
No.
They have excess money to spend. They love their sport.
Yeah.
And they love going, being obnoxious in other cities. Cleveland, Detroit.
Absolutely.
Seattle,
go for it.
Chicago.
Yeah.
They were there at 8. When I got to the ballpark at 8:45, they were all waiting, and there was a portable bar outside, and they were waiting for the bar to open.
Amazing!
And they were all wearing their blue swag and stuff. And I think that that's the huge part of it, and that's why I don't think that this Blue Jays front office can afford to let this thing slip for 2 years where they're going to go into a partial rebuild and come back with Bo Bichette and come back with Vlad Jr.
Yeah,
I don't think they can do that. They've been painted into a corner by these millennial crowds that go and take over Wrigley Field.
They're number one in attendance 2 years in a row.
Take over Fenway.
Yeah.
And it's a great thing, but this team isn't that far off. I mean, it's not like you're rebuilding from 65 wins.
No.
These guys are probably going to finish the year with 75, 76 wins.
And they got horribly injured. Sanchez didn't pitch all year. It was a bad year.
In fact, the next player that comes up to the Blue Jays, which might be on real soon.
Yeah.
Is going to give them 55 for the season, which ties their club record on where, you know, September.
Yeah,
September is when you bring all these guys in normally.
Right. Do you think that means they give Josh Donaldson $225 million and they just don't even think about it? Like, whatever. We have to do it.
I don't think they will.
But then how are they going to thread the needle that they want?
They didn't do it with David Price.
Right. Well, he's a pitcher.
Yeah, but also, you know, they would have made the effort with Alex Anthopoulos as GM.
Yes.
Because he had made that deal thinking, well, I'll try and re-sign him and make it worthwhile. But this, the Cleveland group was brought in to replicate Cleveland's game plan. And I don't think that includes having a guy like Josh Donaldson making that much money into the future. You know, they might let him play out his contract, but I think they're going to really explore in the upcoming offseason finding a great package for him.
Yeah, and I mean...
But it doesn't mean they can't win 85 games if they trade him.
Sure. It depends on other guys bouncing back, Sanchez and Stroman, all that stuff. Yeah. But it just, it makes it difficult, that degree of difficulty, because, and I've written about, I mean, as an outsider, I'm trying to write about it for Sportsnet and The Athletic about... Forget about the Jays for a second. The general idea of how do you achieve success. And the Yankees, you'll notice in this era, never rebuilt. They had a really good year in like 13 or whatever it was. And then they kind of came down, but they never rebuilt. And then Sanchez and Judge emerged, out, rising from the ashes. And then they were just really good again. And they had that luxury, and the Jays are a large market, and there's a lot of expectations. And they always say, well, you can't expect to rebuild in New York. Maybe you can't expect to rebuild in Toronto anymore either.
Well, the thing about the Yankee rebuild, when they traded away people at the 2016 deadline, was that their farm system, they knew their farm system was ready to throw five or six key players into the mix.
Yeah.
And the Jays farm system isn't ready to throw five or six people
into the mix. Vladimir Bichette or A-ball, yeah.
And, you know, they've got Lourdes Gurriel, who's on a major league contract. He's 24, 25. Yeah. He was hurt. He's playing at New Hampshire now, so that's a short jump.
Yeah.
So they'll bring him into spring training, 25 years old, and played at the Cuban upper levels, even though it wasn't like as a regular. And they've got Anthony Alford, so they've only got two guys, and none of their pitchers. They've got a pack of high draft pick pitchers at Double A who are all having mediocre seasons at the same time. It's a mediocre rotation of number one picks for the Blue Jays.
Yeah, and they traded Hoffman, they traded Norris, they traded Boyd, which was fine.
Yeah,
too low price, great. All the stuff is great. You don't have any regrets, but it's just sort of a tough situation. So, I mean, as you know, more broadly, as somebody who came up in the Montreal sphere, Montreal fandom, witnessed the Habs. I mean, it was part of your own DNA, of course. And you've come to Toronto. The interest in the Jays, the growing interest in the Raptors, which is awesome. This doesn't feel like, oh, what a hockey team. It doesn't feel like we're in Green Bay anymore, where it's a one sport situation and there's some other stuff going on. It feels like Toronto sports fans are just rabid sports fans who want to get into it. I have to imagine that somebody, obviously you're writing about the X's and O's too, but that's got to be a pretty cool backdrop to witness that, because it doesn't feel like it was there other than the Leafs, you know, just a few years ago.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, the Raptors came in and then came on, and you know, there's a hugely diverse population in Toronto that has allowed the Raptors fan base in the stadium to really excel and be rowdy and the talk of the NBA. Baseball and hockey, my feeling here in Toronto is that the belief that Toronto is only a hockey town comes from the fact that all of these media members were hockey guys.
Yeah.
And now they come in and they just want to talk hockey on radio, on TV. And so you could make a case that the Toronto media is a hockey media.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not so sure, because
especially the younger generation, they might have grown up playing basketball, and they might be black, brown, whatever, a different background, different this, that.
And there's very, very smart baseball fan base in Toronto. I mean, they know a lot.
Oh, big time.
Yeah, they know a lot
more going to than these events, these pitch talks events and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that whole, very affectionately call it the Andrew Stoughton Mafia. You know what I mean? Just like the real literate bloggers and the readers. And it's really interesting.
And whenever there's an online poll, even on the MLB network, and they have to stream here, Canadians vote like crazy. You know, you look at Josh Donaldson getting the top vote total in the All-Star game. You look at Bautista doing it 2 years.
Yeah.
Canadian fans love their baseball, know their baseball coast to coast, obviously, because you go to Seattle, you go to Wrigley Field, you go to Fenway Park, the Maritimers invade, you know? And you can't just say it's a hockey town anymore. And you know, I saw one guy with a Maple Leafs hat, and it had all these years on one side, and it stopped at 67, and I said, the other ones are on the other side, right? And he didn't think that was very funny.
I like that.
But it's tremendous baseball country.
Yeah.
And it's a tremendous basketball market here.
It really is.
And it's nice to see that, and soccer, you look at TFC.
Yeah.
TFC is having the greatest year they've ever had, and maybe of any team in that league.
Yeah.
And for years they took it on the chin. Now they're the same thing. There's a huge fan base following them. And, you know, it's nice to see Toronto as a hotbed for sports and a large market rather than just a medium to small market as they tried to sell themselves not that many years ago.
Right, it never matched the demographics nor the wealth of the city, that this is a booming metropolis. It might be the most diverse city in North America. I mean, it's up there with New York in terms of diversity. It's just unbelievable and really cool to witness from a sports point of view. And I like the fact, by the way, that they didn't need Roger Savard to stuff the ballot boxes for JD and Bautista.
When I started talking about the computer voting, that's the first thought that went to my head. God bless you, Roger.
So one last question, Rich, which I do at the end of every podcast, is I always ask the guests for a life tip, a nugget of wisdom. I meet you at a bar. I have met you at bars before. And we start chatting, and I say, I'm Joan, I'm all about this. And you say that you are all about this. And it doesn't have to be serious or inspirational or tear-jerking. It could be something silly. It could be something little. It could be part of your daily routine, but it's just quintessentially a rich thing.
Well, it begins with, what if you lose?
I like that very much.
And then it goes on to family. And, you know, there's nothing better than having kids. And I brought my boys up to be baseball, sports fans. My two grandsons, runs the gamut. Every sport, he's playing every sport. Don't be a one-trick pony. Experience everything there is to life and treat people well.
I like it very much. Rich Griffin, thank you so much for your time. We'll read you at the Toronto Star and your occasionally acerbic but always amusing takes as well on social media. So I look forward to that.
Thanks, Jordan.